Oh, hello and welcome to Blockchain Insider. I'm Mauricio Magaldi, Global Strategy Director for Crypto at 11FS, and this is episode 193. As usual, I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Kai Sheffield, Head of Crypto at Visa. Welcome, Kai. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Excited to look back on the predictions from earlier in the year. It's been a fascinating year for crypto. We got a lot to discuss.
Absolutely. As we just passed the halfway mark for the year, we wanted to take a peek at some of the things we predicted, whether they would happen this year, and see what did we predict correctly? What did we get completely wrong? What still has potential to materialize in the next few months leading up to 2024? So let's dive right in. So before we do it, just as a reminder to listeners, the views or opinions of our panel are their own and don't necessarily reflect those of the companies that they are representing. And as always, nothing we say should be taken as tax, financial, or legal advice. So go do your own research. Let's kick this off. So to start, we will take a look at the predictions from this year, January. Prediction number one was, how do you think regulators will deal with centralized crypto players? What are the key areas regulators will focus on? Big, big predictions. So you said, I would expect to see increasing scrutiny on centralized exchanges, not just from regulators, but consumers. This is what we started to see over the past months. A lot of new tools being built to follow and track exchange addresses. Everyone used to just trust exchanges. Now we're seeing real activity when it comes to the following everything that's happening on chain. So how did we fare on that, Kai?
So it's interesting. I think if we go back to, what was it, January, when we made these predictions, you know, FTX was still, you know, the collapse of FTX was still very recent. You know, that happened in November. And so it takes a while, you know, for, you know, a lot of the impact, you know, from a large scale event like that, you know, to happen. It takes a while for cases to be built and the overall tone and strategy from regulators to shift. And it seems very clear that centralized exchanges, you know, have, you know, been a focus point for regulators in the United States, particularly the SEC. And there have been a number of actions that have happened. But I don't think, you know, the challenges that centralized exchanges have had are really just, you know, from a regulatory perspective. I think that more consumers that come into the space are going to be looking at, you know, many new applications of things that they can do. And so on one hand, yes, there are, you know, questions about, you know, what are our securities and commodities, and, you know, it makes sense that exchanges are really just, you know, in the forefront of where the SEC is focusing. But I think there's just going to be more and more wallets. And that's been one of the most interesting things that I've seen this year, is the number of new self-custodial wallets launching, the number of innovations around self-custodial wallets, where it's not that consumers, the only choice they have, you know, is interacting, you know, with an exchange. And so I think that the market landscape of how consumers are going to come into the space could change, you know, quite a bit, you know, going forward over the next 12 months. And, you know, I think it's been a challenge, and many of the exchanges are, you know, going to court and fighting the SEC. We'll see, you know, where that lands, but there'll be many options for consumers outside of just a handful of large centralized exchanges like we saw last cycle. But what do you think?
Yeah, I feel the same, is that decentralization doesn't matter until it does. It's kind of that vibe right now. And you brought a point very interesting. We saw recently the launch of new features on the Floors NFT app, and we saw the Beam wallet being announced last week. These are all Web3 self-custodial wallets, but they have niche use cases that are very peculiar and very similar to Web2 use cases. So I feel that this kind of consumer concern about being, you know, dependent on a centralized exchange to on-ramp in a crypto, as crypto evolves, especially with the introduction of standards such as the account abstraction standards on Ethereum, UX becomes more compelling, and you as a user stop being so dependent on decentralized actors, which is one angle to this discussion. I think the other angle to this discussion is that regulators around the world are also progressing more towards more legislators currently than regulators. So a few cases we saw in the first half of the year is Japan the government issued a Web3 white paper to promote Web3 in the country, which is a very different stance from 2022, where they even banned stablecoins. In the UK specifically, I'm based in the UK, we saw two major legislations come in. One was the ETDB, the Electronic Trade Documents Bill, that will enable the use of blockchains to record documentation on trade finance. And because trade finance, this one becomes English common law. English common law is used in 80% of the trade finance contracts in the world, give or take. So it is a significant progress in fostering adoption. And we have the Financial Services and Markets Bill that got incorporated digital assets and crypto as a financial services asset class as part of the legislation, which is important. We saw MiCA late last year, early this year, and a new registration regimen in Hong Kong for VASPs or centralized crypto providers. So it's not just that we're seeing more regulation come out, we're seeing better regulation come out. And this plays a big part on how this industry evolves, whether you're a centralized player or not. So it feels that although there is a lot of contention and belligerence in some jurisdictions, the rest of the world is kind of trying to figure out how to best welcome this new market. It's not that being friendly is probably not the best word to kind of describe this. It's more being welcome to what is new and embracing this in ways that everyone can actually benefit. What do you think this indicates going forward?
I think we also have to acknowledge just how much progress has happened on the legislative side in the United States, where, you know, if I remember correctly, in January, like, you know, there were not, you know, crypto-related bills, market structure bills, stablecoin bills that were being taken seriously. It was still kind of the fallout of, whoa, this major event happened. You know, how do we clean this up? How do we protect consumers? But there's not interest in, you know, let's make some new rules. The interest seemed to be more about, you know, enforcement. And there was this kind of, you know, pretty big backlash, you know, against the industry. But over time, it seems like there's just been a bunch of progress on both sides of the aisle saying, you know, there clearly need to be some new rules. The question is, you know, who should make the rules? You know, there's one argument that says, oh, the SEC has everything they need, and it's really just about enforcing them. But there's an increasing number of people saying, no, like, you know, the courts have a role to play, but you know, everything that happens at the courts then kind of reinforces that maybe there need to be some rules that are created at the in Congress. And so seeing the success that McHenry has had, you know, even on a limited sense, kind of getting this, you know, initial market structure bill, you know, voted, you know, out of the committee, it seems like there is momentum in that direction, which is a balance to a lot of the regulation by enforcement that's happening. But as you mentioned, this is such a global industry. And, you know, it seems like, you know, the U.S. has been lagging behind in terms of, you know, creating some of these clear rules that other jurisdictions, you know, have. And it's going to be really interesting to see if the U.S. is able to catch up, and if that happens, you know, through courts, if that happens through legislating.
Yeah, my point on the whole regulation by enforcement, which is the term that crypto as an industry has been using for some of what's happening in the U.S., is that it kind of provides specific resolutions against or in favor of a particular case. But when that happens, because it's on the court, it's not going through a whole legislative process where the cross impact with other rules and regulations are analyzed and then framed so they don't become contrary to what exists. So I'll give you an example. The courts that ruled the XRP was not a security on the secondary market. Everybody got excited that XRP, which is Ripple's cryptocurrency, was ruled out not as a security. Even, you know, there was price action related to that, which was, you know, obviously to be expected. But the way the court ruled kind of almost promoted a way that or indicated that it would be preferred that the parties are unknown. And we know that financial services has a clear regulation on your customer. So how do those things kind of merge when a ruling kind of incentivizes something that other legislation is obviously against. So this is one of the things that I feel, and the efforts that you just described in Congress are important, is that clarity doesn't come from litigation. Clarity comes from working to understand the new framework, the new paradigm. And I feel that if we see bipartisan support, especially in the US, it's super influential around the world, we're going to see better progress. And as I said, it's not just friendly regulation. I don't think the industry expects friendliness. I think we expect welcoming and clear frameworks that we can actually build with, because it's all about solving wider problems, especially in financial services, right? So I feel that it's kind of where we're seeing legislation and regulation play a part. But it's interesting also that although there is this kind of litigation in place, there's also space for innovators and regulators to collaborate, right? So an example that we saw late last year and continues to be true this year is Singapore has a massive program with the banks, doing a lot of progress in DeFi. We're going to touch upon that in a minute. And also in Brazil, like Brazil has a whole, like there's a list of projects, especially in the context of the digital real, which is Brazil's wholesale CBDC, welcoming the industry to actually understand, given the existing regulations, what is it that you can build and what do you need from future regulation that will enable you to build better and more? So I think that is also refreshing and reassuring to see that there is space for collaboration in the industry. Is there any other place you're seeing collaboration between, say, legislators or regulators and the industry that you would like to kind of point out?
It's one of the reasons why working in crypto is fascinating. Like you have people trying to build a product that are, you know, now trying to interpret, you know, court rulings and kind of what's the judicial process. And now I'm trying to learn about the legislative process. Okay, pass the committee. Now there are so many different elements that, you know, in many ways it's really interesting, and it's forcing more people to get interested in, you know, how does the judicial system work. But on the other hand, it's just very hard to build products. So, you know, most industries, you know, a product manager is not actively reading case law. Like it's just like, that's what lawyers do. And, you know, huge gratitude for all the crypto lawyers out there. But we're in this really interesting transitionary period in the space where there's just so many unknowns around how it will evolve. And there's so many different stakeholders that have different interests, you know, whether it's, you know, the courts, whether it's legislators, and then even within legislators, you know, it's not even just, you know, bipartisan, or it's not even just based upon, you know, Democrat or Republican. It's, you know, generational. It's, you look at the age of many of the elected representatives and their views, you know, on the space. And so, you know, there are all these different, you know, moving pieces. But I think, you know, one of the biggest takeaways is there's a recognition that this isn't going away. And that it's important enough that it's worth, you know, spending time on. And the fact that you have, you know, two, you know, presidential candidates, at least two, you know, I said, even if they are the long shots, that are actively, you know, talking about the crypto industry, you know, as a part of their campaign, it feels like it's kind of a when, not if, we get, you know, to a point where there's some clarity on what the rules are. And it's really hard to predict, you know, what exactly will those rules be, and where will the compromises, you know, be made between, you know, the industry and between elected representatives and all these stakeholders? But it's not all going away. And I think this is very different than, you know, even last cycle when I look back to, you know, what were people thinking about in 2018 and 2019, and, you know, there were people thinking, okay, maybe the only thing that is going to exist is Bitcoin. You know, maybe Ethereum, you know, isn't going to exist. Maybe there's really nothing else that you'll do with this technology other than, you know, digital gold. And I think now, you know, there is this broader recognition that there are going to be many applications, you know, for, you know, smart contract platforms and public blockchains, that they're not just going to be Bitcoin. But it's going to take years, you know, for, you know, the clarity in these rules to pan out. But what I'm excited about is people aren't waiting for it in order to build products. It will influence where they build products. It'll influence where they launch products. But there aren't innovators and builders that are going home and they're saying, wake me up in 3 years or 4 years, you know, when there are some rules. And it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out.
Which brings me kind of to a point which is also very refreshing, is that we're seeing, obviously, other major jurisdictions that are relevant in the global stage to get organized, like Europe and the UK and even the BRICS. But we're also seeing the global south rally a lot around crypto. And it's remarkable how with very little, they can build a lot. Like, especially payments and remittances in the global south, which is a big chunk of some of these local economies, are increasingly more reliant on the use of stable coins and crypto payment rails to kind of get the job done, because it's easier to use, it's cheaper, they can be protected from the local inflation or the local currency devaluation. And this helps to kind of bring them a little bit more of, I wouldn't say financial independence, but maybe financial inclusion might be the case here. And this is also one of those, you know, overarching sentiments in crypto that we say that the widespread adoption is going to come from the global south. And we're seeing that happen in real time and on chain, which is always refreshing. So if we have more welcoming regulatory frameworks, it's likely that we're going to see that even more widespread, even if it's just a single use case. I love the Beam wallet pitching the Venmo of Web3 kind of vibe. Like, Venmo is a winner on UX by itself. And if Beam can replicate that success in Web3 anywhere in the world, because it's, again, borderless, we're going to see a lot of non-Web3 natives coming in because it's just so easy to use. And UX is really where it's at. So hopefully that also puts a little bit of less of a pressure in legislators and regulators, and more of a pressure in building the right thing, building well and building great UX, so we can actually do that onboarding of the next billion users, as we love to say. What do you think?
This is one of the biggest trends that I've seen so far this year. And it's just the pace of development of wallets. There are, you know, I come across a handful of new wallets that I've never seen or heard before, launching pretty much on a weekly basis. And yeah, I've got like 50 downloaded on my phone now that I'm playing around with and trying out. And this vision, this concept of a global Venmo, you know, has been around and has been talked about in the crypto industry for a while. But I think the infrastructure wasn't really there to support it until recently. And I think there are a few pieces that are required. And the first is just the scalability of blockchains. Like if you wanted to build a global Venmo in 2019, you know, good luck. Like they're just, you know, you're building on ETH, you know, layer one. You know, the gas fees are gonna be, you know, cost prohibitive. There weren't that many other options. And so I think now what we're seeing is there are dozen plus options if you want to build a global Venmo on either layer twos on top of Ethereum, and then you got, you know, a whole ecosystem. Okay, well, which layer two, and what are you optimizing for? And I think you know, the Beam wallet is one of the layer twos, and then you have the alternative layer ones. You've got Solana, you've got Aptos, you've got Sui, you've got it. So it went from almost, for builders, there were really no choices and no options if you wanted to create a wallet that could do, you know, instant, you know, fast, cheap, you know, cross border payments. To now, it's almost like there are too many options. And like, that's part of the challenge, is that you have people, you have new wallets that are popping up on all of these different layer twos or all of these different alternative layer ones, and they don't really talk to each other yet. And so it's almost like we need some consolidation down to what are the chains that are going to be used, you know, for, you know, cross-border, you know, payments. So I think that's one, you know, major advancement, is just blockchains can scale enough that they're fast and cheap, where you can build some of these products. And the other is on-ramps and off-ramps, you know, continue to improve. And so, you know, there's still a long way to go, but, you know, being able to, in particularly in emerging markets, use Pix, you know, as an on-ramp and off-ramp, you know, into a wallet or an exchange, using UPI in India, using local wallets. I think we were seeing, you know, companies like MFS Africa and the ability to use mobile money as on-ramps and off-ramps. And so I think that when you have blockchain scaling and you have on and off ramps maturing, those are really the two key ingredients. And then you just need to have, you know, builders and designers that, you know, can create, you know, intuitive products that consumers can easily use. And we have to figure out, okay, which of the blockchains, it doesn't make sense to have global Venmos on, you know, dozens of different blockchains. But we're finally at the point where the infrastructure works. It works well enough to build products that people have talked about for years. And I think that's one of the really exciting, you know, moments for the space right now.
Maybe that's why Mr. Elon Musk now decided to finally pivot the Bluebird app to an X super app that will probably, in his own words, be the future of finance. So now the infrastructure is there. He is a crypto bro for sure. We can only speculate.
Who knows? I will not attempt to predict anything that Elon Musk would do.
And we're probably going to be surprised anyway. So that's great. So let's take a quick pause here, hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Visa, one of the world's leaders in digital payments. Crypto has opened up a new world of possibilities, and Visa's helping everyone take part. Consumers can now enjoy the freedom and flexibility of using their Visa crypto link cards for everyday purchases at millions of Visa-accepting merchant locations around the world. Join us in this new money movement. Learn more at visa.com/crypto.
Keeping up with all the noise and news from the world of financial services isn't easy. It's easy to get lost in buzzwords, jargon, and industry speak, so sometimes you just need a quick human rundown of the biggest stories. Well, you are in luck. Bite-sized is our very own weekly newsletter that takes the biggest news stories from financial services and tells you exactly what's happening, why it matters, and what comes next. Bite-sized goes out every Friday at 11 a.m, so you can enjoy it with a coffee as you wrap up your week. Stay up to speed with the fast-moving world of financial services and subscribe today at 11fs.com/newsletters. That's 11fs.com/newsletters.
So welcome back. Continuing our predictions, the next one was, will DeFi sandboxes become a thing for progressive regulators? We kind of leaned a lot on Project Guardian when we discussed about this. Project Guardian, if you guys don't recall, is a project sponsored by the Monetary Authority of Singapore with participating banks and crypto companies, banks like JP Morgan and DBS, crypto companies like Aave and Fireblocks and Polygon. So this is operating in the space that DGens hate, which is regulated DeFi. So that was an example. They recently announced that they're expanding the program. They're including more banks. They're including more crypto companies, and they are expanding in terms of the types of use cases and the types of, and I'm going to say here, quote unquote, money equivalents between tokenized deposits, CBDCs, and cryptocurrencies themselves to kind of try and capture all of that space. And that is just one of the examples. So that is probably the major one, and it doesn't seem to me that we have achieved kind of escape velocity between progressive regulators and the crypto space. Although Italy, the Italian Central Bank announced that they're partnering also with Polygon and other players to actually explore more of DeFi in the context of TradFi. So it feels that we kind of indicated that, but it's not as big as the other predictions, or it hasn't picked up to the extent of these other predictions. My take on this is that we have the rest of the year to become further and further away from FTX and SVB, so that regulators can now pay attention to some of these innovations and actually bring them into the fold and start doing that. So it's not exactly that we nail this, but I think it's still a good indicator for the next few months until we wrap up the year. What is your perception on this, Kai?
Definitely a trend that takes a lot more time to play out. I think first, maybe it's interesting to just start with, where has the narrative gone around CBDC? And, you know, we've heard about CBDC. We've talked about CBDC on the show for many years now. And I think, the first real phase of CBDC, which I'd say is almost like, 2019 to 2021, maybe 2022. And it was really started with, concern about, Libra. And it was kind of this reaction. And it was saying, wait a minute, like, shouldn't, if they're going to be these digital currencies, it could be created by, tech platforms, like, shouldn't the central bank, shouldn't that be the central bank's job? And so there was a lot of interest in retail CBDC, a lot of papers, a lot of studies, a lot of experiments. We saw some markets, like China that launched theirs, and continue to pilot it, still TBD what the actual adoption and how much consumers actually want it. We saw other markets like Nigeria experiment with it, did not really have much success. And I think over time, kind of the further central banks have gotten, they've really recognized it's just really, really hard to build direct-to-consumer products and to create this brand new ecosystem and who's asking for it. And if consumers don't really want it, you got to compete with existing products that work really well. And so now I think we've seen a lot more interest from central banks in wholesale CBDC rather than retail. But instead of just wholesale CBDC on its own, it's been really looking at, what could this future financial infrastructure look like if you combine a wholesale CBDC with this new term of, tokenized deposits? And so is there a role for banks to play representing commercial bank liabilities, on chain that can then be settled when they're transferred via a wholesale CBDC? And it's a pretty complex, ecosystem. And there are a bunch of different designs, and there's the regulated liability network, and there are a bunch of pilots and experiments happening. We've been involved in some in Hong Kong and in Brazil. And so I think that's been the biggest focus, is to say, okay, how do central banks and payment providers, technology companies work together in this new tokenized asset ecosystem? And then what are the motivations and what are the use cases? And I think people have, particularly in markets like Brazil, Pix works really well. They've had a lot of success with their retail, real-time payment network. And so I think it's become less central banks trying to reinvent retail payments and recognizing there's less of demand in many markets for consumers, and they kind of, what they have works pretty well. And more thinking about what are these futuristic use cases of tokenized assets, of programmable finance and DeFi, and what could you do if stocks and bonds and cash all existed on the same ledger and you had these permission liquidity pools? And so it is this really interesting time, which I think is a better focus in at least thinking kind of far out in the future of what new things could we uniquely do if we leveraged this new infrastructure in a controlled, regulated way between central banks and banks, rather than how do we enable someone to pay for their coffee, which we always kind of said of like the motivation of creating a brand new complex central bank retail payments for someone to pay for their coffee, just doesn't, there's not really a high ROI on that. So I think it's in a much better place in terms of focusing on tokenized assets, capital market innovation, atomic delivery versus payment. But on the other hand, this stuff is incredibly complex. And this is not just, okay, how do you send value from point A to point B? It's how are assets issued on top of these new networks, and then what protocols are these assets? That takes a lot longer to play out, but I think it's a better focus. And so I expect we'll continue to see more and more experiments from the forward-thinking central banks like Singapore and Hong Kong and Brazil and others, but it will be more about capital markets innovation than it will be about retail or even B2B payment innovation. And I think that's where programmable finance and DeFi protocols, and there'll be a lot of kind of crossover between there. But that's not something that you solve and kind of deploy commercially in 12 months. But I think it is, there will be seeds planted that become really interesting new financial market infrastructure over the next 5 years that come out of some of the pilots that happen in the next 12 to 24 months.
No, absolutely. And interesting you mentioned this, because one of the things that I feel CBDC, especially wholesale CBDCs, I brought this up before. I'm not a big fan of retail CBDCs for various reasons, but I'm a big fan of wholesale CBDCs because even the relationship between central banks and the commercial banks, and even between commercial banks, they are complex. They are heavy lifting. There's a lot of data coming back and forth. There's very little space for automation in the way that they operate today. But having the ability to program how these things happen at the protocol level is something they've never had. And this by itself is a major opportunity. And it also speaks to the whole phenomenon of tokenization. If anything kind of jumped in front of financial services this year, was tokenization of what they call real world assets, which in the real world is just called assets. It's just having the ability to capture the corresponding asset and the corresponding behavior of that asset on chain and have it programmed. And every time it has a particular business event in that asset's life cycle, be able to actually trigger that on chain and do whatever corresponding action very transparently with awareness of the parties involved. And if it involves a lag of liquidity, leverage the use of a wholesale CBDC that's operating in that same space. Because tokenization without the corresponding liquidity is just a notary. And blockchains don't need to be just a notary. They have a programmable layer that if you ignore, you're just underutilizing the infrastructure, which is obviously not built to build for, not cheap to build for. So I really feel that especially in the wholesale space, the large financial operations, I feel that there is a lot of space for the real world asset tokenization to become just simply how banks do things between themselves and the central banks, because there is a lot of opportunity there in terms of efficiencies that they haven't been able to tap just yet. And I feel that that's what kind of CBDCs will end up triggering. And the counterpart of that is that also gives a lot of transparency to the counterpart emission of what you said, tokenized deposits, which is what Project Guardian and other projects around the world are trying to determine, which was not something we heard of last year. It was very little, no articles, no nothing, and then Project Guardian came, and now banks in general are more inclined to say, well, if I have a CBDC, a wholesale CBDC on my back end, can I issue a digital real or whatever the currency is that I can actually go and say, well, if the companies and the individuals want to use that, it's going to look like a stable coin, but it's backed by the CBDC that I have here on my balance sheet. So it creates a better relationship between the circulating supply and the money that they have in store with the central bank. So I feel that transparency and programmability are big winners when we talk about tokenization. And that will not happen in the regulated financial services without the support of a wholesale CBDC more specifically. So this is, as you said, it's a play of a decade. It's not a play for next year, but the foundation is being discussed. And as more central banks realize what the model, what model works for them, we're going to see things like we're seeing in Brazil with the Lyft program. And in the UK now, we have the recurring sandbox. So the sandbox was a kind of start and finish kind of program. And now it's open forever. You can apply from, I think it's now in August and onward. Anyone will be able to actually apply for the sandbox and get to use it. And that is the opportunity to blend open data with open finance and digital assets in ways that we haven't seen before, which to me kind of points to a very promising future of actually being able to bake in all of that innovation under the guise of the regulator, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting to see there's the other trend around this has been tokenized real world assets coming onto public blockchains and then into kind of the open crypto ecosystem And so, you know, shout out to Real World Assets, RWA.xyz. It's a really interesting tracker around, you know, the different tokenized treasuries. You know, there's really quietly $600 million of tokenized T-bills that are now on chain across, you know, Stellar, across Ethereum. We've seen Franklin Templeton. We've seen startups like Ondo that have been super active there. And so you have, you know, treasury bills being represented on chain. You know, it's kind of the stablecoin equivalent of, you know, someone's holding a treasury bill, issuing a token that's you know, able to be redeemed for that. And that's, you know, starting to trade, and, you know, people are buying and selling them, you know, with stablecoins. And so how much of real world assets will come onto public blockchains versus will permissioned networks and tokenized deposits, you know, be, you know, the only way that, that some asset issuers or some banks are comfortable? And then what types of assets are really going to drive this? Like, people talk about, you know, these new next gen capital markets and tokenized assets, and you're like, okay, well, where do you start? It's pretty easy to say, oh, if everything existed in the same ledger and all assets were issued here, then, you know, things would be great. But how would we actually get there? You know, are treasuries, T-bills going to be the first, or what types of bonds, and, you know, what role do the asset issuers play versus banks versus, is it institutional versus retail? I think there's still a bunch of open questions, and, you know, people have been talking about securities tokens and crypto since 2017. It feels like there's actually been, you know, more progress in tokenized real world assets in 2023 than any other year that I can remember. And so I think that's kind of quietly, you know, happened in the background.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting segue on our third prediction, which is more use cases for NFTs, non-fungible tokens. Some of these are real world assets that have been tokenized. Not every real world asset is a fungible asset, right? So we had an interesting take, and I'm going to read from my cheat sheet what you said. For the LinkedIn crowd, NFTs have been surprisingly resilient, and there's a lot more activity in NFTs than most people who aren't actively following probably realize. There is still a lot of activity, just that it's something that is worth watching. We've seen a little bit of a kind of disaster strike crypto native collectibles recently with, say, apes and Azukis and punks and others, but we also saw a number of large players, especially in the like high-end luxury and the automotive sector, actually tackling NFTs to manage their communities. It's really becoming that decentralized CRM primitive we keep talking about, Kai. Do you feel that we, in this prediction, we were precise? Did we nail this one?
So it depends. It depends how we measure it. I still think there's a lot of really interesting things happening. I think you have, on one end, these are digital luxury goods. And we've seen that use case, whether it's Bored Apes or punks. And you know, things come into style, they go out of style. And I think in many ways, NFTs were a beneficiary of, you know, people made money in crypto as market prices went up. And it's a new generation, a kind of a new demographic, and a new kind of, you know, cultural you know, community of people who are making money in crypto, and they chose to spend that money. They'd rather spend it on, you know, some high-priced JPEGs than they would on a Rolex or a car. And so I think that that's, you know, pretty straightforward to think about. You know, it's not going to be the last time that we see that, you know, as, you know, crypto continues to rise and fall, you know, through different cycles, that new millennial, affluent millennial and Gen Z consumers have a propensity and an interest in spending money on high-priced digital luxury goods. And now the question is, you know, some of those are crypto-native, you know, projects that are, you know, from the ground up. Some of those are traditional luxury goods, you know, providers that are coming on chain. And so looking at, you know, what Tiffany's did, you know, with their CryptoPunk collaboration, Louis Vuitton just did an on-chain, you know, trunk, you know, NFT that, you know, by owning this and the NFT, you get access to exclusive, you know, products. We've seen Nike and the Swoosh platform, you know, continue to get, you know, good amount of adoption and then do some interesting collaborations where you can take, you know, the Swoosh NFTs and then use them, you know, inside of games. And so I think that we're going to have, you know, this, you know, digital luxury, you know, component. And then the other piece that really has been most interesting to me has been the return to art. There is a lot of interest in particularly generative art as a new kind of modern art form. And so to see, you know, the success of art blocks, you know, I think it's Sotheby's now who has their own, you know, generative art, you know, platform. There are new gen art platforms like Prohibition, you know, launching on layer twos, you know, like Arbitrum. And it's kind of refreshing in a way because, you know, there is a genuine interest in these new form factors of, you know, how can you write code where the code itself, you know, is art, and it creates these really interesting visual outputs that can tell stories and can have real impact. And I've been dabbling and playing around with some of these, and like, there is a real community of people who are excited about art, and blockchains are enabling this new form of art rather than the reverse, where I think PFPs and some of the earlier, you know, projects, you know, that took off in the bull market, it's a lot harder to consider Bored Apes art than it is, you know, to look at a this really interesting generative art piece that has, you know, a lot of different components to it that tells the story related to someone's, you know, experiences. And so I think generative art is something that's going to come out of this bear market as a, you know, art form that is going to be increasingly acknowledged by traditional art collectors, by traditional museums, and that is uniquely enabled by blockchains. And that will be a big category, you know, of NFTs. And then you have the CRM, you know, instead of buying an NFT for $1 million, can you mint a million NFTs, you know, to all of your customers just as, you know, a way that they can interact with you and be able to do that for a dollar? And that wasn't really possible when blockchains were too expensive. You can't do that on Ethereum. You can't really use, you know, Ethereum NFTs as a CRM because it's just the gas fee to mint is cost prohibitive. I think seeing some of the experiments happening on Polygon, on layer twos, on Solana, there are going to be many mass market NFTs that are more about loyalty and engagement than they are about any secondary market that that NFT might have. And so I see it almost as like, there's going to be a bunch of activity at the high end, digital luxury goods and fine generative art. And then there's going to be a bunch of, you know, how do you use these things as loyalty programs and CRMs that's going to be at the low end. And I think there'll be innovation on both those sides. And even if the trading volume is down, I have more conviction that this technology will be increasingly useful in a number of different areas over the next few years.
Yeah, it's interesting you say this because recently in one tech event in Brazil, a project called Gotas Social, which is Social Drops, they are minting millions of NFTs at a very low cost. And they had like, I don't know, I think it's like 50,000 people in the audience being able to scan a QR code and mint Gotas NFT on their wallet immediately. Like it's a massive movement. And exactly because now we have this kind of affordability of an infrastructure that you can actually do that at scale. In the same vein, we're seeing Starbucks continues with the Odyssey program. There are more crypto native companies coming into the loyalty space, trying to recreate a better user experience for loyalty holders, even trading across different loyalty programs, the points, because points are kind of tokens the same way. And we're seeing Reddit still using the avatars. So it's not just, I mean, it is a primitive in the sense that you can build from it multiple use cases. And the way it behaves is the way that you program it to behave, right? And it's that's the edge where we want to see this play in the digital space. And which kind of brings me to another innovation in this space, which is the nestable NFTs that was a new Ethereum standard that was launched recently, is that an NFT can own NFTs from other smart contracts, which means that now you can create different experiences by combining different NFTs from different sources or different issuers in ways that right now might seem a little bit too complicated, but the amount of unlocking in terms of collaborating experiences you can have in the digital space now is unlike anything you could have before that without a lot of heavy lifting. So this new standard kind of allows an NFT that you have to own another NFT or other NFTs from other issuers. And that is something that only open source in crypto is able to achieve. So another one that's pretty refreshing and very promising coming forward.
Yeah, it's a new design space for consumer applications. And I think that's going to lead to a bunch of creativity and innovation. And the other important trend that I think will help accelerate it is the concept of wallet as a service. You know, NFTs need wallets. You know, they have to sit in a wallet somewhere. And if, you know, to start an NFT experience, when someone shows up, if you have to say, oh, go download a wallet, then they have to leave your app. They have to go, you know, interact with another brand that you don't control, that, you know, they're not accustomed to the onboarding, and then their seed words. And then by the time they come back, they're like, oh, who cares? And particularly for some of those use cases where you just want someone to claim a free NFT, going and downloading and setting up MetaMask for the first time just to claim a free NFT probably doesn't really make sense. But now, you know, seeing you've got, you know, a number of different wallet as a service, you know, providers from, you know, Web3 Auth and Magic Link and Sequence, and Coinbase has one now, and Circle has one. I think you'll see merchants and developers, you know, start to integrate wallets into the existing experiences. And so you could just, you know, one click claim an NFT. And by doing that, you know, you're spinning up a self-custodial wallet, you know, tied to your email that you can now use. I think the question will be, how do those work across different applications? I think that there are ways to do it today that can be a really good experience inside one application. But then it gets kind of siloed where, you know, I don't want to have, you know, five different wallets each tied to one, you know, individual application. I think NFTs get really powerful when they become these, you know, digital backpacks that you bring all your belongings with you, you know, everywhere you go across the internet. And I think that there's a role, particularly in ad tech, you know, as them becoming this modern cookie, where you can, you know, have consumers opt in, you know, to claim something or to collect something that says something about themselves, and then, you know, choose to share that, you know, with merchants across the internet. And I think that that's really, really powerful in an age where, you know, everyone I talk to in the advertising and marketing space, like, it's getting harder and harder, you know, to be able to acquire customers, and customer acquisition costs are going up, and you have less data than you've had before with some of the Apple, you know, changes to app tracking. And so I think that's a whole nother space that, you know, doesn't get talked about as much, but, you know, how could NFTs become kind of better cookies that consumers can opt into that can then, you know, transform some of the e-commerce landscape?
Absolutely. Oh my God, way too many things. So many things, so little time. So that kind of brings up us up to the end of our session today. Thanks, Kai, for joining us today. Where can people find more about you?
Still saying on Twitter, at Kai Sheffield. Everyone knows what I mean. I can't get used to sadex.com and visa.com/crypto.
You can also find me on the Bird app. It's not a bird anymore. On the Bird app at 0x Mauricio, on LinkedIn at Mauricio Magaldi, and 11fs.com. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. We have lots in the works, and we're so excited to be talking about crypto and blockchain with you again. If you can't wait until the next episode, take a look at the many previous episodes on our back catalog and get yourself properly immersed in the world of crypto. And if you really love it, please leave us a review. It helps us to make it better and helps other people find the show. As always, if you want to join the conversation, find us on social media. Just search for 11FS or Blockchain Insider, or email us at podcasts@11fs.com. This is all for today. Stay rare, stay weird. LFG.